Hey guys, welcome to the Orthodox Christian Podcast. And we had a couple questions come in through the form, so just wanted to take a look at those today. I will say, as a disclaimer, that I am not an expert in every single subject, and Orthodoxy is pretty broad and it's been around for a long time. So some of these topics you could drill down into and speak about for a really long time, or write probably a PhD dissertation on. So I'm just going to try to give the best info I can and point people in hopefully the right direction. But just please bear in mind that these topics are a lot broader and deeper than I can go into in a brief Q&A. So the first one is, why didn't the Oriental Orthodox have the right to reject the councils that they didn't formally hold to? I thought reception theory implied they could reject them and the church should not dogmatize those councils without the Orientals' agreement. So this is an extremely technical question, and for those that may not know, there are the Oriental Orthodox churches and the Orthodox churches, or Eastern Orthodox churches. And so the Oriental Orthodox churches would be in Egypt or in Ethiopia and other places in that general area. And the Eastern Orthodox churches would be traditionally in lands like Greece or Russia or wherever else. And at present, the Eastern Orthodox churches are larger in general, and the Oriental Orthodox churches are slightly smaller, just in terms of total numbers of adherents. But historically, the Oriental Orthodox churches and the Orthodox churches had these councils, or just the ancient Christians had councils, and there were a number of them. And until the third one, the Oriental Orthodox and the Eastern Orthodox were on the same page. At the fourth one, they had some disagreements and went their separate ways, more or less. And the councils were held to talk about how Christ was fully human and fully divine, or in what way Christ was human and divine, because the practice of the church teaches that, and the scriptures teach that, but how to actually articulate it properly is pretty difficult. And so there were a number of councils held to try to find language that was suitable for this mystery of the incarnation. And the two problems that the ancient Christians were trying to avoid were, on one hand, the union, the overemphasis on the union of Christ's humanity and divinity, where the divinity of Christ would essentially swallow the humanity so that the humanity would cease to exist. And then on the other extreme, you had a complete separation between the divinity and the humanity, where Christ was maybe seen as just a human person, and he was adopted by God at a particular point in his life, say during his baptism when the dove descends on him. So the church was trying to figure out how to speak about Christ as fully human, fully divine, but avoid those two errors. And the reason that was important was because Christ's relationship, the relationship of divinity and humanity in Christ, dictates how we relate to God. And so if on one hand the humanity of Christ was just swallowed up in divinity, well, then we would have this notion that we as individuals lose ourselves in God. We cease to exist as unique persons. And that would be this notion of sort of a drop of water dissolving into a lake. Whereas on the other hand, you might have this idea that there's an unbridgeable gap between humanity and divinity. We can't actually really know God. We can't commune with God. And so those are important practical considerations, and they trace back to Christ and how he is divine and human. And so in the ancient church, they had these councils to talk about that, to work things out. And at the fourth council, there was a disagreement between the Oriental Orthodox and the Eastern Orthodox, and they went their separate ways. So to this question, that's some of the background, but why didn't the Oriental Orthodox have the right to reject the councils that they didn't formally hold to? Well, I mean, technically, they did have the right because that's what they did. And the next part, I thought reception theory implied they could reject them and the church should not dogmatize those councils without the Orientals' agreement. Now, what's interesting is that in recent years, like 80s and 90s, there have been some agreements between the Oriental Orthodox and the Eastern Orthodox that essentially say they are using different words to describe the same reality, and in fact, they hold the same faith. And now, that doesn't mean that the Oriental Orthodox and the Eastern Orthodox are perfectly united today. They aren't, unfortunately, but there is theoretically no need for division between the two groups. And so I will link those documents, that these like formal agreements, in the description, so you can check those out if they're of help. But I think nowadays there's a lot more common ground, because things aren't quite as heated, and the two groups are able to see that they're speaking about the same reality. They actually have the same faith. They're just using different words to speak about that. So hope that is helpful. On to the next. This one says, many Anglicans teach that their church was founded in the British Isles in the first century, and apart from the Catholic and Orthodox churches, and way before Henry VIII. If this is true, why not consider them a true church? So I think that, from what I know, that it is accurate to say that the Anglicans do have a unique history, and that there are these unique saints from the British Isles, and there's a long lineage that does go back before Henry VIII and the Reformation. So that part's true. I think, though, what needs to be considered is the current practice in the Anglican Church. And so I would say that this is true in general across Christianity. Like, it doesn't necessarily matter. Well, it does matter. The lineage matters in terms of the history of the church and what have you. But what is really important is the current practice. And so if you have this long lineage that goes back, but the current practice is completely different, then the lineage doesn't count for a lot. And just to give an example of that, if you had a long lineage of plumbers in your life, say your grandfather was a plumber and your great-grandfather was a plumber, and all the way back there were plumbers, but you're not a plumber, well, it doesn't make a huge difference. If someone comes to you and they need their sink fixed, you're not going to be able to assist them very well. And I think, I mean, it's a bit of a silly example, but there's a parallel there with the Anglican churches, where there might be this long history of Christians that had a sense of ancient Christianity, that had this notion that God and the world are truly connected, and we can unite with God through the tangible things of the world. So that would be by praying to images of Christ and using them as aids to prayer, or by receiving the body and blood of Christ in the Eucharist, or by being baptized and being united with Christ in that way, or the other quote-unquote sacraments. If the current practice of the church doesn't actually uphold those things, then it doesn't really mean very much. And from what I know of current Anglican practice, you've got some people that are very much favorable towards ancient Christianity. You have other people that aren't, and would say that, well, icons are idols and we should destroy those. We shouldn't have any images. That the body and blood of Christ aren't present in the Eucharist, that it's more of a spiritual reality that unites us with God. That only Christ saves us, that baptism doesn't save us in any way. So that just makes it really difficult to hold on to that lineage, because the current practice is very diverse. And from my experience in an Anglican church, it felt like you could have everything you wanted, but it was optional. And so there wasn't a clear identity, a clear sense of this ancient Christianity or sacramental Christianity that was alive and present in the Anglican church. So I think for me, what's important is the current practice of the church, not just where it's been in the past. Because if they're no longer practicing that, it doesn't mean very much. Just like if your grandfather was a plumber, but you've got a broken sink in front of you and you're not a plumber, well, it doesn't really, it's not going to help you in that situation. And for a great reference to this, you can read The Inner Kingdom by Callistos Ware, just the first chapter. It talks about his conversion from Anglicanism to Orthodoxy, and he traces out some of the differences in Anglicanism at that time that are still present between the Low Church, which was very much anti-sacramental, very reformed in their theology, very Calvinist in their theology, and the High Church, which was more Catholic or Orthodox in their theology and practice, and then liberal Christianity, which was, as Father Lawrence Farley mentioned in his interview, cutting at the roots of ancient Christianity or just Christianity in general and taking it in a completely different direction. So that really is still the case in Anglicanism. And so I think that there are good individual parishes, but as a collective, it's just harder to recommend that path. Anyways, I hope that's somewhat helpful. I will have the link to the Inner Kingdom in the description of this video, as well as the document that shows the agreement between the Oriental Orthodox and the Eastern Orthodox. And if you guys have any further questions, please feel free to submit them through the form. That'll also be in the description. Have a peaceful week. See ya.